Today, on a special holiday edition of Flashpoints, we spend the hour with Howard Zinn, Alice Walker, Anthony Arnov, Mos Def, Aya De Leon, Melanie Damore, Steve Earle, Nora El-Samahi, John Trudell, and Luis Valdez, reading the voices of A People's History of the United States in part two of a two-part production recorded in Berkeley in November 2006. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In his best-selling book, A People's History of the United States, legendary historian Howard Zinn takes the reader through this country's history based on the words and perspectives of the indigenous, the enslaved, and the dispossessed, the revolutionaries, the dissidents, and the activists. 2 years ago, Zinn and Anthony Arnov, who together co-wrote Voices of a People's History of the United States, came to Berkeley and brought with them a collective of luminaries, visionaries, writers, musicians, and actors to make history come alive on stage. Zinn and Arnov were joined by Alice Walker, Mos Def, Aya De Leon, Melanie Damore, Steve Earle, Nora El-Samahi, John Trudell, and Luis Valdez in this benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance, the Vanguard Foundation, and Speak Out. Up next is the second riveting hour of that performance. Listen to this.
The Japanese-American civil rights activist Yuri Kochiyama was born and raised in San Pedro, California. She and her family were among the 120,000 Japanese-Americans on the West Coast who were rounded up in a wave of anti-Japanese hysteria that followed the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Here she recalls her experiences during the Japanese internment.
I was red, white, and blue when I was growing up. I taught Sunday school and was very, very American. But I was also very provincial. We were just kids rooting for our high school. I was 19 at the time of the evacuation. I had just finished junior college. I was looking for a job and didn't realize how different the school world was from the work world. In the school world, I never felt racism. But when you got into the work world, it was very difficult. This was 1941. Just before the war. I finally did get a job at a department store, but for us back then it was a big thing because I don't think they'd ever hired an Asian in a department store before. I tried because I saw a Mexican friend who got a job there. Everything changed for me on the day Pearl Harbor was bombed. On that very day, December 7th, the FBI came and took my father. He had just come home from the hospital that day. For several days, we didn't know where they had taken him. Then we find out that he was taken to the federal prison at Terminal Island. Overnight, things changed for us. Most Japanese Americans had to give up their jobs, whatever they did, and were told they had to leave. The edict for 9066, President Roosevelt's edict for evacuation, was in February 1942. We were moved to a detention center that April. We were sent to an assembly center in Arcadia, California in April. It was the largest assembly center on the West Coast, having nearly 20,000 people. There were some smaller centers with about 600 people. All along the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, there were many, many, many assembly centers, but ours was the largest. Most of the assembly centers were either fairgrounds or racetracks. So many of us lived in stables. And they said you could take whatever you could carry. I was so red, white, and blue, I couldn't believe this was happening to us. America would never do a thing like this to us. This is the greatest country in the world. So I thought, this is only going to be for a short while, maybe a few weeks or something, and they'll let us go back. At the beginning, no one realized how long this would go on. I didn't feel the anger that much because I thought, maybe this was the way we could show our love for our country. And we should not make too much fuss or noise. We should abide by what they asked of us. I'm a totally different person now than I was back then. I was naive about so many things. The more I think about, the more I realize how little you learn about American history. It's just what they want you to know. We called the camps relocation centers while we were there. Now we feel it is apropos to call them concentration camps. It is not the same as the concentration camps of Europe. Those, we feel, were death camps. Concentration camps were a concentration of people placed in an area and disempowered and disenfranchised. So it is apropos to call what I was in a concentration camp. Historically, Americans have always been putting people behind walls. First, there were the American Indians who were put on reservations, Africans in slavery, their lives on the plantations, Chicanos doing migratory work, and the kinds of camps they lived in, and even to the Chinese when they worked on the railroad camps, where they were almost isolated, dispossessed people, disempowered. And I feel those are the things we should fight against so they won't happen again. This whole period of what the Japanese went through is important. If we can see the connections of how often this happens in history, we can stem the tide of these things happening again by speaking out against them.
While some civil rights leaders urged a more cautious approach to winning civil rights, Malcolm X expressed the feelings of many blacks that more uncompromising methods of struggle were needed. Like members of the Black Panther Party, Malcolm X advocated the right of armed self-defense for blacks and other oppressed groups who lived in so violently racist a society as the United States. Here is an excerpt of a speech Malcolm X delivered in Detroit, Michigan, 2 years after giving the speech, February 21st, 1965. He was assassinated in New York City.
I just want to say that Malcolm X is one of my favorite people and one of my favorite thinkers and speakers. So it's a special pleasure to read one of his speeches, as he also has one of my favorite lines ever. And I'll say it slowly so you guys know what I'm saying. We want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand. We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not wanted. Once you face this as a fact, then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist, and you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you were an American, you wouldn't catch hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason. So we're all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You're nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that, but what else are you? You are ex-slaves. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You came here on a slave ship in chains, and you were bought here by the people who came here on the Mayflower. And you were bought here by the so-called pilgrims or founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here. We have a common enemy. We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. But once we all realize that we have a common enemy, then we unite on the basis of what we have in common. And what we have foremost in common is that enemy, the white man. He's an enemy to all of us. I know some of you all think that some of them aren't enemies. Time will tell. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. That revolution was for what? For land. Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. The French Revolution, what was it based on? The landless against the landlord, what was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. The Russian Revolution, what was it based on? Land, the landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. You're afraid to bleed. As long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people, but when it comes to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got any blood. You bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite, and you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How are you going to be nonviolent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered? If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it is wrong to be violent defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it is wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in her defense of her. And if it is right for America to draft us and teach us how to be violent in defense of her, then it is right for you and me to do whatever is necessary to defend our people, our own people, right here in this country.
The civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer was born in Montgomery County, Mississippi, the daughter of two sharecroppers. In 1962, she joined a group of 18 blacks who traveled to the courthouse in Indianola to register to vote. At the time, fewer than 7% of blacks were registered to vote in Mississippi. Here, Hamer, a leader of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, describes to the Credentials Committee of the Democratic National Convention in Washington, D.C. in 1964, the treatment she and others received for trying to vote.
Mr. Chairman and the Credentials Committee, my name is Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, and I live at 626 East Lafayette Street, Ruleville, Mississippi, Sunflower County, the home of Senator James O. Eastland and Senator Stennis. It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the country courthouse in Indianola to try to register, to try to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by Mississippi men, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Ruleville, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color. After we paid the fine among us, we continued on to Ruleville, and Reverend Jeff Sunny carried me 4 miles in the rural area where I had worked as a timekeeper and sharecropper for 18 years. I was met there by my children, who told me the plantation owner was angry because I had gone down to try to register. After they told me, my husband came and said that the plantation owner was raising Cain because I had tried to register. And before he quit talking, the plantation owner came and said, "Fannie Lou, do you know, did Pap tell you what I said?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I mean that. If you don't go down there and withdraw your registration, you will have to leave because we are not ready for that in Mississippi." And I addressed him and told him and said, "Well, I didn't try to register for you. I tried to register for myself." I had to leave that same night. On the 10th of September, 1962, 16 bullets was fired into the home of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Tucker for me. That same night, two girls were shot in Ruleville, Mississippi. Also, Mr. Joe McDonald's house was shot in. And in June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop and was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by the Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, which is Montgomery County, four of the people got off to use the washroom and two of the people to use the restaurant. Two of the people wanted to use the washroom. The four people that had gone in to use the restaurant was ordered out. During this time, I was on the bus. But when I looked through the window and saw they had rushed out, I got off of the bus to see what had happened. And one of the ladies said, "It was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out." I got back on the bus, and one of the persons that used the washroom got back on the bus too. As soon as I was seated on the bus, I saw when they began to get the four people in a highway patrolman's car. I stepped off of the bus to see what was happening, and somebody screamed from the car that the four workers was in and said, "Get that one there." And when I went to get in the car, when the man told me I was under arrest, he kicked me. I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room. They left some of the people in the booking room and began to place us in cells. I was placed in a cell with a young woman called Mrs. Uvesta Simpson. After I was placed in the cell, I began to hear the sounds of kicks and screams. I could hear somebody say, "Can you say, 'Yes, sir, nigger? Can you say, 'Yes, sir?'" And they would say other horrible names. She would say, "Yes, I can say, 'Yes, sir.' So say it." She says, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her I don't know how long, and after a while, she began to pray and asked God to have mercy on those people. And it wasn't too long before three white men came to my cell. One of these men was a state highway patrolman, and he asked me where I was from, and I told him Rouville, and he said, "We are going to check this." And they left my cell, and it wasn't too long before they came back. He said, "You are from Rouville, all right," and he used a curse word. And he said, "We are going to make you wish you was dead." I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had two Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman for me, to lay down on a bunk bed on my face, and I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat, and I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. And I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat me until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro who had beat me to sit on my feet to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and to tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high, he walked over and pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this is on account we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hooks because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
In 1964, Ismael Guadalupe Ortiz helped organize one of the first protests against the use of the island of Vieques in Puerto Rico for U.S. military bombing practice. The struggle continued until 2003, when the movement finally forced the U.S. military to end its use of the island. Here is a speech Ismael Guadalupe Ortiz gave in 1979 about the struggle in Vieques before being sent to jail for his protests.
My name is Ismael Guadalupe Ortiz. I am 35 years old. All my life, I have lived in Vieques. For the last 13 years, I have been a high school teacher in the public schools. Many years ago, I began to fight for the right of my Viequense brothers to live in peace. Today, I come here not as the accused. I come as the accuser. I accuse the U.S. Navy and the court of the U.S. in Puerto Rico of conspiring to commit against all Viequenses one of the greatest abuses ever brought against a people in our America. I accuse the U.S. Navy and its legal arm, the federal court, of expropriating and throwing into the street thousands of human beings that live on these lands and that now this Navy claims is theirs. Who are the witnesses that I will call to prove my accusation? To begin with, my own parents were victims of this expropriation. To continue, I call hundreds of Viequenses who are still alive to attest to how it was in the 1940s. Women who had to give birth in cane fields because the birth coincided with the passage of the bulldozers that were knocking down their houses. Of men and women who woke up without a piece of land to cultivate for their or their family sustenance. All Viequenses remember the death of Chulto Legrand, a 12-year-old boy, victim of one of the many bombs that the Navy left on our soil. The elders tell us how the body of Alejandro Rosado was found on the lands occupied by the Navy, buried with his head down and his feet up. The elders tell us about the deaths of Anastasio and Domingo Acosta, father and son, victims of the Navy's bombs. Juan Maisonet, Elena Holliday, and many more form links in the chain of victims of flesh and blood and of names and surnames. Nonetheless, today you judge me for getting together with my brother Viequenses to fight against these injustices committed by the North American Navy in my island of Vieques. As a Viequense, as a Puerto Rican, and as a father of two children, I feel legitimately proud to be at the side of my people at this time. That my children will be able to say that I am a prisoner because I don't want Vieques to be for them what it was for me. That I do not want for them or any other child of my small island to be a land bombed and shot at wildly at the whim of foreigners. For my children and for the little friends, the abuses of today will be a thing of the past, or perhaps a lesson in a schoolroom about what happened in Vieques, and never to let it happen again anywhere else. This is why I fight. This court today can send me to prison, but outside remain thousands who will continue the struggle, which is the struggle of all the people.
In March of 1987, the political movement to confront the AIDS crisis found militant expression with the formation of ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power in New York. Here, activist Vito Russo, a founding member of ACT UP, talks about his experience confronting the AIDS crisis.
A friend of mine in New York has a half-fare transit card, which means that you get on buses and subways for half price. And the other day, when he showed his card to the token attendant, the attendant asked what his disability was, and he said, "I have AIDS." And the attendant said, "No, you don't. If you had AIDS, you'd be home dying." And so I wanted to speak out today as someone who has AIDS and is not dying. You know, for the last 3 years since I was diagnosed, my family thinks two things about my situation. One, they think I'm going to die. And two, They think that my government is doing absolutely everything in their power to stop that. And they're wrong on both counts. If I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from homophobia. If I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from racism. If I'm dying from anything, it's from indifference and red tape, because these are the things that are preventing an end to this crisis. If I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from Jesse Helms. If I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from the President of the United States. And if I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from the sensationalism of newspapers and magazines and television shows, which are interested in me as a human interest story only as long as I'm willing to be a helpless victim, but not if I am fighting for my life. If I'm dying from anything, I'm dying from the fact that not enough rich, white, heterosexual men have gotten AIDS for anyone. You know, living with AIDS in this country is like living in the Twilight Zone. Living with AIDS is like living through a war, which is only happening for those people who happen to be in the trenches. Every time a shell explodes, you look around and you discover that you've lost more of your friends, but no one else notices. It isn't happening to them. You're walking through the streets, and people are acting as though we weren't living through some sort of nightmare. And only you can hear the screams of the people who are dying and their cries for help. No one else seems to be noticing. Someday, the AIDS crisis will be over. Remember that. And when that day comes, when that day has come and gone, there will be people alive on this earth, gay people and straight people, men and women, black and white, who will hear the story that once there was a terrible disease in this country and all over the world, and that a brave group of people stood up and fought, and in some cases gave their lives so that other people might live. And we have to commit ourselves to doing that. And then, after we out of this disease, we're all going to be alive to get out of this system so that it never happens again. Ooh.
The farm worker leader Cesar Chavez was born in Arizona, grew up in migrant labor camps. In the early 1960s, he helped found the United Farm Workers Union. He came to international attention in 1968 when he announced a boycott of California grapes. The boycott in protest of the anti-union efforts of California growers led to millions of dollars in losses for agribusiness and led to historic contracts with the United Farm Workers. And in this speech given in San Francisco in 1984, Chavez describes the unfinished struggle of farm workers for justice.
21 years ago, last September, on a lonely stretch of railroad track paralleling U.S. Highway 101 near Salinas, 32 Bracero farm workers lost their lives in a tragic accident. The Braceros had been imported from Mexico to work on California farms. They died when their bus, which was converted from a flatbed truck, drove in front of a freight train. Conversion of the bus had not been approved by any government agency. The driver had tunnel vision. Most of the bodies lay unidentified for days. No one, including the grower who employed the workers, even knew their names. Today, thousands of farm workers live under savage conditions, beneath trees and amid garbage and human excrement. Near tomato fields in San Diego County, tomato fields which use the most modern farm technology. Vicious rats gnaw on them as they sleep. They walk miles to buy food at inflated prices, and they carry in water from irrigation pumps. Child labor is still common in many farm areas. As much as 30% of Northern California's garlic harvesters are underaged children. Kids as young as 6 years old have voted in state-conducted union elections since they qualified as workers. Some 800,000 underage children work with their families harvesting crops across America. Babies born to migrant workers suffer 25% higher infant mortality than the rest of the population. Malnutrition among migrant worker children is 10 times higher than the national rate. Farm workers' average life expectancy is still 49 years, compared to 73 years for the average American. All my life, I have been driven by one dream, one goal, one vision: to overthrow a farm labor system in this nation which treats farm workers as if they were not human beings, but beasts of burden to be used and discarded. That dream was born in my youth. It was nurtured in my early days of organizing. It has flourished. It has been attacked. I'm not very different from anyone else who has ever tried to accomplish something with his life. My motivation comes from my personal life, from watching what my mother and father went through when I was growing up, from what we experienced as migrant farm workers in California. That dream, that vision, grew from my own experience with racism, with hope, with the desire to be treated fairly and to see my people treated as human beings and not as chattel. It grew from anger and rage, emotions I felt 40 years ago, when people of my color were denied the right to see a movie or eat at a restaurant in many parts of California. It grew from the frustration and humiliation I felt as a boy who couldn't understand how the growers could abuse and exploit farm workers when there's so many of us and so few of them. Later in the 50s, I experienced a different kind of exploitation. In San Jose and Los Angeles and other urban communities, we, the Mexican-American people, were dominated by a majority that was Anglo. I began to realize what other minority people had discovered, that the only answer, the only hope, was in organizing. We organized. I didn't really appreciate it at the time, but the coming of our union signaled the start of a great change among Hispanics that are only now beginning to see. The union's power in agriculture has nothing to do with the number of farm workers under union contract. It has nothing to do with the farm workers' ability to contribute to democratic politicians. It doesn't even have much to do with our ability to conduct successful boycotts. History and inevitability are on our side. The farm workers and their children, and the Hispanics and their children, are the future in California, and corporate growers are the past. Our union has been on the cutting edge of a people's cause, and you cannot do away with an entire people. You cannot stamp out a people's cause. Like the other immigrant groups, the day will come when we will win the economic and political rewards which are in keeping with our numbers in society. The day will come when the politicians do the right thing by our people out of political necessity and not out of charity or idealism. That day may not come this year. That day may not come during this decade, but it will come someday. And when that day comes, we shall see the fulfillment of that passage from the book of Matthew in the New Testament, that the last shall be the first, and the first shall be the last. And on that day, our nation shall fulfill its creed, and that fulfillment shall enrich us all.
The black feminist writer and activist June Jordan wrote of ordinary people's loves, desires, struggles, and passions, both personal and political. Jordan, who died of breast cancer in June 2002, was an internationalist committed to breaking down boundaries of nation and ethnicity. As her friend Alice Walker said, she was an inhabitant of the entire universe. On February 21st, 1991, the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, she spoke at a rally in Hayward, California, against the war in the Gulf.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this killer crusade, this conversion of a stranger's land into a killing field, this reduction of a people to a video display, This homicidal rhetoric that history does not support, that our common destiny is certain to condemn, this war has not saved one human being. This war has not saved a single American life. This war has not saved a single Israeli life. This war has not saved a single Iraqi life. This war has not rescued the lives of Kuwait. This grand undertaking, this enormous, this infinitely casual overkill, this draining of our hearts, this annihilation of all tenderness, this erasure of every reason, every rational and civilized approach to dispute, this arched and leering assault upon all peaceable possibilities, this blasphemy unleashed against our shrunken, trembling earth that has become, in the hellified lexicon of the killers ruling us, a target-rich environment, this war has not saved one human being from terror or from unspeakable agonies of extinction. Then why do we permit this blasphemy to persist, expand, and explode our body politic as well as the entire Middle East? I grieve the sorrow roar, the sorrow sob. I grieve the monstrous consequences of this war. But I am reassured, because not every American has lost his mind or her soul. Not every one of my compatriots who become a flag-wrapped lunatic, lusting after oil and power, the perversions of kicking ass, preferably via TV. A huge number of Americans has joined with enormous numbers of Arab peoples and European communities in Germany, England, France, Italy, Spain, and Muslim communities throughout India and Pakistan to cry out, stop. When I say huge, I mean it. If 1,000 Americans contacted by some pollster can be said to represent 250 million people, then how many millions, multi-millions, do we anti-war movement gatherings of more than 100,000 coast to coast and on every continent, how many do we represent? How come nobody ever does that kind of political math? Tonight, February 21st, 1991, when yet again the ruling white men of America despise peace and sneer at negotiations and intensify their arm's-length armchair prosecution of this evil war, this display of racist value system that will never allow for any nationalism that is not their own, and that will never allow third world countries to control their own natural resources, that will never, ever express, let alone feel, regret, or remorse, or shame, or horror at the loss of any human life that is not white. Tonight, I am particularly proud to be an African American. By launching the heaviest air assault in history against Iraq on January 15th, George Bush dared to desecrate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. Tonight, and 83,000 bombing missions later, is the 26th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. On this sorry evening, the world has seen the pathological real deal behind the sanctimonious rhetoric of Bush and company. The Persian War is not about Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. This war is not about Kuwait at all. Clearly, it's not about international law or respect or United Nations resolutions, since by comparison to Washington and Pretoria, the butcher of Baghdad is a minor league Johnny come lately to the realm of outlaw conduct and contempt for world opinion. I want to say something specific to you, Mr. President. It's true, you can humiliate, and you can hound, and you can smash and burn and terrify, and smirk and boast and defame and demonize, and dismiss and incinerate and starve. And yes, you can force somebody, force a people to surrender what happens to remain of their bloody bowels into your grasping, bony, dry hands. But all of us who are weak, we watch you, and we learn from your hatred, and we do not forget. And we are ready, Mr. President. We are most of the people on this God-forsaken planet.
Two of the first people to speak out against the use of September 11th as a pretext for war were Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez. Their son Gregory, then only 31 years old, was killed that day while working on the 103rd floor of the World Trade Center. The Rodriguezes sent this open letter to the New York Times only 4 days after 9/11.
Nuestro hijo, Greg, está entre los muchos que faltan después del ataque de las Torres Gemelas. Our son, Greg, is among the many missing from the World Trade Center attack. Since we first heard the news, we have shared moments of grief, comfort, hope, despair, fond memories with his wife, the two families, our friends and neighbors, his loving colleagues at Cantor Fitzgerald Eastmead, and all the grieving families that daily meet at the Hotel Pierre. Vemos nuestro dolor y rabia reflejado entre todos que conocemos. We see our hurt and anger reflected among everybody we meet. We cannot pay attention to the daily flow of news about this disaster, but we read enough of the news to sense that our government is heading in the direction of violent revenge with the prospect of sons, daughters, parents, friends in distant lands dying, suffering and nursing further grievances against us. It is not the way to go. It will not avenge our son's death, not in our son's name. Nuestro hijo se murió víctima de una ideología inhumana. Nuestras acciones no deben servir el mismo propósito. Our son died a victim of an inhuman ideology. Our actions should not serve the same purpose. Let us grieve. Let us reflect and pray. Let us think about a rational response that brings real peace and justice to our world. But let us not, as a nation, add to the inhumanity of our times.
Rachel Corey, a student at Evergreen College and a member of the Olympia Movement for Justice and Peace, traveled to the Gaza Strip in Palestine in early 2003 as a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement. On March 16, 2003, she was killed when she was run over by a caterpillar bulldozer while trying to block the destruction of a Palestinian home. The bulldozer was driven by an Israeli, but built in the United States. The driver could not have failed to see Corey, who was wearing a bright orange jacket and who announced her presence through a bullhorn. After her death, Corey's family and friends released copies of her moving letters describing the struggle against the U.S.-backed occupation of Palestinian lands. Here is one of her letters home.
Hi, friends and family and others. I have been in Palestine for 2 weeks and 1 hour now, and I still have very few words to describe what I see. It is most difficult for me to think about what's going on here when I sit down to write back to the United States. Something about the virtual portal of luxury into luxury. I don't know if many of the children here have ever existed without tank shell holes in their walls and the towers of an occupying army surveying them constantly from the near horizons. I think, although I'm not entirely sure, that even the smallest of these children understands that life is not like this everywhere. An 8-year-old was shot and killed by an Israeli tank 2 days before I got here, and many of the children murmur his name to me, Ali, or point at the posters of him on the walls. The children also love to get me to practice my limited Arabic by asking me, Kaif Sharon, Kaif Bush? And they laugh when I say, Bush Majnun, Sharon Majnun, back in my limited Arabic. How is Sharon? How is Bush? Bush is crazy. Sharon is crazy. Of course, this isn't quite what I believe, and some of the adults who have the English correct me. Bush Mish Majnun. Bush is a businessman. Today I tried to learn to say Bush is a tool, but I don't think it translated quite right. But anyway, there are eight-year-olds here much more aware of the workings of the global power structure than I was just a few years ago. Nevertheless, no amount of reading, attendance at conferences, documentary viewing, and word of mouth could have prepared me for the reality of the situation here. You just can't imagine it unless you see it. And even then, you're always well aware that your experience of it is not at all the reality. What with the difficulties the Israeli army would face if they shot an unarmed U.S. citizen, and with the fact that I have money to buy water when the army destroys wells, and the fact, of course, that I have the option of leaving. Nobody in my family has been shot driving in their car by a rocket launcher from a tower at the end of a major street in my hometown. I have a home. I'm allowed to go to see the ocean. When I leave for school or work, I can be relatively certain that there will not be a heavily armed soldier waiting halfway between Mud Bay and downtown Olympia at a checkpoint with the power to decide whether I can go about my business and whether I can get home again when I'm done. As an afterthought to all this rambling, I am in Rafah, a city of about 140,000 people, approximately 60% of whom are refugees, many of whom are twice and three times refugees. Today, as I walked on top of the rubble where homes once stood, Egyptian soldiers called to me from the other side of the border, "Go, go," because a tank was coming. And then waving, and, "What's your name?" Something disturbing about this friendly curiosity. It reminded me of how much, to some degree, we are all kids curious about other kids. Egyptian kids shouting at strange women wandering into the path of tanks. Palestinian kids shot from the tanks when they peek out from behind walls to see what's going on. International kids standing in front of tanks with banners. Israeli kids in the tanks, anonymously, occasionally shouting and also occasionally waving, many forced to be here, many just aggressive, shooting into the houses as we wander away. I've been having trouble accessing news about the outside world here, but I hear an escalation of war on Iraq is inevitable. There is a great deal of concern here about the, quote, reoccupation of Gaza. Gaza is reoccupied every day to various extents, but I think the fear is that the tanks will enter all the streets and remain here instead of entering some of the streets and then withdrawing after some hours or days to observe and shoot from the edges of the communities. If people aren't already thinking about the consequences of this war for the people of the entire region, then I hope you will start.
Cindy Sheehan's son, Casey, was killed in action in Iraq on April 4, 2004. This is a speech she delivered in August at a Veterans for Peace convention in Dallas, Texas, just before heading down to camp outside of Bush's vacation home in Crawford, Texas. President Bush refused to meet with her, but Sheehan helped galvanize sentiment against the occupation of Iraq.
I said to my son not to go. I said, "You know it's wrong. You know you're going over there. You know your unit might have to kill innocent people. You know you might die." And he says, "My buddies are going. If I don't go, my buddies will be in danger. 30 of our bravest young men have already died this month, and it's only the 5th of August. And the tragedy of the Marines in Ohio is awful. But do you think George Bush will interrupt his vacation and go visit the families of the 20 Marines that have died in Ohio this week? No, because he doesn't care. He doesn't have a heart. That's not enough to stop his little playing cowboy game in Crawford for 5 weeks. So as you can imagine, every day the grieving parents that have lost, no, I don't like to use that word. The parents whose child was murdered. It's extremely difficult. You can't even get a small scab on her wound because every day it's ripped open. So anyway, when that Phil Spewer and warmonger George Bush was speaking after the tragedy of the Marines on Ohio, he said a couple of things that outraged me. Seriously outraged me. George Bush was talking, and he never mentioned the terrible incidents of those Marines, but he did say that the families of the ones who've been killed can rest assured that their loved ones died for a noble cause. He also said, he says this often, and this really drives me crazy, he said that we have to stay in Iraq and complete the mission to honor the sacrifices of the ones who have fallen. And I say, why should I want one more mother to go through what I've gone through? Because my son is dead. You know what? The only way he can honor my son's sacrifice is to bring the rest of our troops home. To make my son's death count for peace and love and not war and hatred like Bush stands for. I don't want him using my son's death or my family's sacrifice to continue the killing. I don't want him to exploit the honor of my son and others to continue the killing. And I just had this brainstorm. I'm going to Crawford. I don't know where Crawford is, but I don't care. I'm going. And I'm going to go, and I'm going to tell him, you get that evil maniac out here, because a Gold Star mother, somebody whose son's blood is on his hands, has questions for him. And I'm going to say, okay, listen here, George. Number one, I demand every time you get up and spew the filth that you're continuing the killing in Iraq to honor my son's sacrifice, honoring the fallen heroes by continuing the mission, you say, except Casey Sheehan. You don't have permission to use my son's name. And I'm going to say, and you tell me what the noble cause is that my son died for. And if he even starts to say freedom and democracy, I'm going to say, you tell me the truth. You tell me that my son died for oil. You tell me that my son died to make your friends rich. You tell me my son died so you can spread the cancer of Pax Americana imperialism in the Middle East. You get America out of Iraq. You get Israel out of Palestine, and you'll stop the terrorism. And if you think I won't say to the president, then you're wrong. Because I'll say what's on my mind. So anyway, I'm going to go to Crawford tomorrow, and I'm going to say, get George here. And if they say, no, he's not coming out, then I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to put up my tent right here, and I'm staying until he comes and talks to me. Another thing that I'm doing is, my son was killed in 2004, so I'm not paying my taxes for 2004. And I tell everybody that. If I get a letter from the IRS, I'm going to say, you killed my son for this. I don't owe you anything. I live in Vacaville, California. If you can find me there, come and get me and put me up on trial. It's up to us as moral people to break immoral laws and resist. As soon as the leaders of a country lie to you, they have no authority over you. These maniacs have no authority over us. And they might be able to put our bodies in prison, but they can't put our spirits in prison. When I was growing up, it was communists. Now it's terrorists. So you always have to have somebody that's our enemy to be afraid of, so the war machine can build more bombs and guns and bullets and everything. But I do see hope. I see hope in this country. 58% of the American public are with us. We're preaching to the choir, but not everybody in the choir is singing. If all the 58% started singing, this war would end.
We end tonight with a song written in 2002 by singer, songwriter, playwright, and activist Steve Earle from his album, Jerusalem.
This morning, and none of the news was good. Death machines were rumbling across the ground where Jesus stood. And the man on my TV told me it's always been that way. There's nothing anyone can do or say. Almost listened to him. Yeah, I almost lost my mind, and I regained my senses again. Looked into my heart to find. I believed that one fine day all the children of Abraham will lay down their swords forever in Jerusalem. Oh, maybe I'm only dreaming. Yeah, maybe I'm just a fool, but I don't remember learning how to hate in Sunday school. But somewhere along the way I strayed, and I never looked back again. But I still find some comfort now and then. Until the storm comes rumbling in, and I can't lay me down, and the drums are drumming again. I can't stand the sound, but I believe there come a day when the lion and the lamb will lie down in peace together in Jerusalem. Then yeah, there'll be no wiry walls. We can wash all this blood from our hands and all this hatred from our souls. Cause I believe that on that day all the children of Abraham will lay down their swords forever. Amen. We must believe in one fine day all the children of Abraham will lay down their swords forever in Jerusalem.
And that was part two of Voices of a People's History of the United States, recorded in Berkeley in November 2006. Have a great weekend, and thank you for listening.